Grand, so great to see a lot of really familiar faces. That's really good. As you have not met before, looking forward to having a chat over coffee. Don't be a stranger. Feel free to come and talk to me and tell me what you thought. I'm from Christ Central Manchester, which is just up the road. Up the road that way, but we live just up the road that way, just by the hospital. And have been here since about 2001. So I've lost count of the number of times I've driven past, jogged past, walked past your church. And it's a privilege to be here amongst you. Just to kind of get a flavour of the tone of the room, I'm going to give you a phrase, and I genuinely want you to shout out if you feel like you can complete this well-known phrase. Okay, you ready? So the phrase is, I agree with. So there was a suggestion there. Nick, there we go. I agree with Nick. Some of you sitting there going, I have no idea who Nick is or where that phrase came from. 2010 election, they had these TV broadcast debates, and every political party was queuing up to use that immortal phrase. I agree with Nick. It was bizarre just watching it unfold. And the next morning, the only thing the newspapers wanted to comment on was the fact that everybody seemed to be in agreement with Nick. And therefore, why do we need to bother having an election? Because everybody knows Nick is right. Do you know that if you go to Google now and you type, I agree with, it will complete the phrase for you. If you go to Google Images, there are some amazing images of his face in all sorts of psychedelic colours behind with, I agree with Nick, all over it. You can have a look when you go tonight. It's left a kind of indelible mark on our country. It's kind of defined that election in some way. So what defined the one we've just had? What defined the one? Say again?
Strong and stable.
Strong and stable. Yeah. Unfortunately, strong and stable seems to be withering a little bit, doesn't it? But never mind. If you like, I think it was pitched by some as the battle between good and evil. By some. I'm not being in any way political here. I'm just observing what I read on Facebook. That everybody assumed at the start that Theresa May had this unassailable lead, right? That she was untouchable. That she'd called the election at just the right moment. And she wanted to fight the whole election on the basis of strong and stable. On the basis of her personality. Nobody's ever successfully won an election doing that, by the way. When Heath did it, he got absolutely tanked. Something about when you pitch it a whole general election on the basis of your personality, the country doesn't seem to like it that much. But then there was, so that was her kind of push, strong and stable. And then there was this other kind of push coming from the other side, which seemed to try and present her in a bad light and Jeremy Corbyn as the good guy. And it was this kind of battle between good and evil. The propaganda machine kind of pitched it as Corbyn versus May. There were no other contenders, just those two. And it was Harry Potter versus Voldemort. It was Skywalker versus Vader. Frodo versus Sauron. Arnie versus the Predator. Whichever one of those you plug into best. And actually, I was talking to some people, they were almost looking forward to the end of the election because this Facebook social media narrative just got so caricatured. It was unbelievable. The caricature was that May wants to tear down the fabric of our society, whilst Corbyn will single-handedly save the NHS, save our schools, and look after the elderly. And if you ask him nicely, he'll babysit your kids for the weekend as well. She wanted it to be all about Brexit and herself. Facebook wanted it to be about something else. About the role of the state in looking after people. Social media in some way wanted to redefine the election as being about the welfare state. Which is interesting terminology. We kind of take it for granted in our country. The notion that the state has a responsibility for the welfare of the people. And it's a terminology that really only emerged in the 40s, after the war. A swell of public opinion called the government to account because the country was rocking. And then there was a Beveridge report in 1942 which talked about lifelong support for everyone in Britain. Everyone was ensured a standard of living. And actually, it was based upon Christian values of human dignity, equality, and concern for one's neighbour. It was the beginning of national insurance, sick pay, annual leave, pensions, free education, unemployment benefit, and the NHS. And we threw away this notion of an undeserving poor. And the state took a responsibility for looking after all. Now, at different times, that notion has been fractured. So during the 80s, the NHS started to kind of be a victim of its own success. People were living too long and couldn't cope with the need. And at the same time, you had Margaret Thatcher kind of rolling back the role of the state, saying that we're not going to be quite so responsible for looking after people. And in 2015, David Cameron seemed to revert to some fairly archaic language. He referred to an underclass. Do you remember that? It was almost like this Elizabethan notion from the 1600s. So in the 1600s, they had what was called the Poor Law. And it had four groups that were identified. It had children, the aged and the infirm, the genuinely unemployed, and then the so-called willfully idle. So the young and the sick and the unfortunate, they were to be cared for, but the work-shy were to be punished under the Poor Law. And David Cameron's language of the undeserving, the underclass, almost kind of encouraged us to go back to that division. The reality is our society at the moment, it faces a whole load of challenges. Austerity, personal debt, benefit cuts, housing shortages, service cutbacks, unemployment, increasing economic inequality, substance abuse, gang culture, youth crime, trafficking, exploitation, the list goes on. And the question is, I suppose, whose fault is it? And maybe the next step, whose responsibility is it? Was it the bankers that ruined everything for us? Is it the government's responsibility? The last government, the future government, this government, your responsibility? Are the poor to blame? Are they work shy, couch potato, Jeremy Kyle fodder, cheating the benefit system? Or is there something more going on? There appears to be an edgy suspicion of those in need that seems to be re-emerging in our country. And there's this long-running political debate about the role of the state in welfare and prosperity. I'm not going to answer that question for you today. That's for you to kind of work out. But there is this question about to what extent should the state intervene to protect the welfare of the vulnerable? But my point for you today is there is no debate around the role of the church in caring for the vulnerable. There is no room for that debate at all. In fact, actually, it was so important to Jesus that when he came to his early 30s, when he came to announce his manifesto, if you like, when he came to declare what he was truly about, he turned to the Old Testament scriptures, opened the pages, and found the verses that he wanted to proclaim to the people in that moment. He found the soundbite that would be on Twitter. He found the image that would be on Snapchat. He found the newspaper headline and he said, "This is how I want the people to know and recognize me." And these are the words that he chose. "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, and to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour." That Jesus stood up in the temple, this was his moment, and these were the words he chose. Good news to the poor, freedom for prisoners, recovery for the sick, and freedom for the oppressed. How true was he to his manifesto? Was it just a juicy soundbite to catch the eye? Or was it really who he was? Was it empty words that we can see right through? Or did he see it through? Time and again, in fact, we see Jesus align himself with the broken, demonstrating that it's not just good politics, but actually his very nature. And this morning I want us to draw in to one of those moments. If you've got a Bible, it's in Mark 5. If you haven't, don't worry, I'm going to read it. And we're going right at the beginning. I'll start reading where you find it and you can catch up. They came to the other side of the sea. Jesus and his disciples, this is. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he'd often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." This description is tragic. It is of a man living alone among tombstones. Living alone on the other side of the water, away from the rest of the community. Afflicted by an unclean spirit that tormented him, that he was angry and unsoothable. So tormented was he that he was unrestrainable. He could not be subdued. He was unable to sleep, so he would spend the night crying out, not a gentle whimper, but roaring at the skies in torment, cutting himself with stones. We aren't told how he got here, but he is alone. He's branded unclean and afflicted, untreatable, untamable, and unlovable. We aren't told what he was like as a child, whether he was a challenging kid, or maybe some kind of trauma inflicted on him in later life left him damaged and maybe changed the course of his life. We aren't told. We aren't told how his family treated him, or what life choices he or they made. But we are told that his anger and his self-harm drove away those who were closest to him. We are told that people had tried to tie him up, chain him up, possibly many times. I wonder why. Maybe to stop him from hurting other people or breaking things. Maybe to administer medical treatment or deliverance. Maybe just simply to ship him out. But it feels like a tragic mix between like brutal medieval medicine and the kind of fear that makes the Incredible Hulk in a movie. This fear and ignorance turned this society, turned this community to abuse this afflicted man. And no doubt that compounded whatever evil influence was in his life. That sense of rejection, that sense of abuse by society. I wonder actually how often our society mistreats and rejects the vulnerable. And actually in turn gives the devil an even stronger foothold than he had before. Yeah, I kind of just used the D word. I don't know if that's okay here. But we do believe there is an enemy who is real. We do believe there's an enemy who has an influence in people's lives. I want to be clear though. I'm not saying that everybody who is poor, sick, or behaves strangely is influenced by an evil spirit or possessed in any way at all. In fact, that isn't what this sermon is about. But what I am doing is drawing a comparison between how our societies treat our most vulnerable. How did this community treat its most vulnerable? How does the society around us treat our most vulnerable? And how does the church treat our most vulnerable? It's tragic, isn't it, when we meet families where everything that could possibly have gone wrong seems to have gone wrong. It's tragic when we see in the news headlines of people who really have had it tough, just get it a little bit tougher. It's tragic that whenever there's a natural disaster, it's the poorest communities that seem to be hit hardest. It's tragic that when there's a fire, it hits the poorest communities hardest. It's kind of a systemic injustice. And it sometimes feels like evil is really good at attaching itself to evil. That when people get hit, it seems like there's another blow coming behind afterwards. Jesus is incredible in this passage. So the guy comes to him and says, don't torment me. And it feels to me like there's been a lot of medical people, lots of doctors, and lots of religious leaders that have tried to come and help this guy. Hopefully well-intentioned, but maybe not always. And so he's got to the point where he's been so hurt and so damaged by these repeated people coming to try and fix him that when Jesus arrives, all he can say is, don't torment me. And my heart and my hope is that actually as a church, you and we would never be a place where people would come and find torment. That we'd be a place where people can come and find healing and wholeness in the same way as this guy does with Jesus. And the truth is actually it costs to love somebody that pushes you away. It costs to love when somebody's behaviour is violent and abusive and loud and disorderly. It challenges the way we do church. Our precious little Sunday morning routines, what do we do when somebody comes in that can't conform to those? What do we do when somebody just wants to shout or break or hurt? But Jesus is completely in charge of this situation. He isn't blinkered by the perception of the society. The people that are around him are kind of saying, actually, you don't need to waste time on this one. We've parked him. He isn't blinkered by that perception. Even with the man shouting, aggressive, presenting behavior, even with the scars, even with the dirt, even with the unkempt presentation, Jesus is not blinkered. He isn't even worried about what his closest friends will think in this moment. He just simply brings release with real calm, power, and authority. And it's remarkable to such extent that later on we see this man in his right mind sat there, neatly clothed, eating and talking with people, and the community are afraid. They're not celebrating, they're afraid. And they ask Jesus to move away because they don't understand this transformation. Jesus brings healing, freedom from oppression and hope. And they ask him to leave. Just a question that always stands out for me about this passage is the whole pig thing. Yeah, we can't do this story without coming there, can we? So what's going on there? So if you're not sure of the story, the narrative tells us that Jesus kind of lifts the evil spirit off the man and into the pigs, and then the pigs then go running over a cliff. And our modern sensibilities really struggle with that, understandably. And there are all sorts of theories. And you read some commentaries and you read some internet stuff, and you can find some absolute rubbish out there. But there's all sorts of ideas about what's going on in the spiritual realm at this point, and some of those ideas are more valid than others. But let me just bring something that's quite practical, if you like. is Jesus has a way of seeing people's hearts, right? He has a way when he interacts with people of kind of speaking in a way that really opens them up. It's like with the rich young ruler. He comes and says, I've fulfilled all the commandments. What shall I do? And Jesus identifies. It's almost like he can read the guy's emails. He knows that the God for this guy is money. So he just speaks into that situation. And when we see Jesus turning over tables in the temple, it's because he sees the heart of the people there and he sees what's going on. He says, this is all wrong. And I think in this situation, Jesus sees the heart of the community. See, this community had given up on this man, perhaps understandably. He was wild. But Jesus wanted this community to understand the heart of God. He wanted them to understand that they should have spent themselves for this guy. See, like I said, rather than being in awe of the miracle, actually they ask him to leave. They're afraid. They don't get on board with what God's doing. And in reality, the main reason why they ask him to leave is because he's damaging the local economy. Because when those pigs go over the cliff, that's pounds and shillings. So I kind of almost think that in that moment, what God wanted them to see was that if they'd spent less time labeling this guy and more time praying and ministering, if they'd been prepared to spend themselves on behalf of the most vulnerable, regardless of the cost, that maybe that would have been closer to God's heart. That I think maybe in the same way as Jesus was turning the tables in the temple, that he was turning the tables here, I think there might even be a degree of anger in Jesus at this point that kind of says, while you guys were quietly lying in your beds, congratulating yourself on your religious observance and your piety, meanwhile this man was out in the tombstones, a precious child of God, howling at the sky, cutting himself with stones. How does that work in a God community? And actually, I feel the tension of that. So our church meets right in the middle of Manchester on the corner of Whitworth Street and Deansgate. And I'm there singing on a Sunday morning, and I know that within a stone's throw of where we're meeting, there will be people scoring drugs. There will be ladies looking to sell themselves. There will be victims of domestic abuse in those tall flats that are just recovering from a crazy wild night. I'll know that there's all sorts of kind of business injustice going on right on the doorstep. How does a community cope with that? But it's okay. Yeah, because when we read these stories, we know that actually it's just about Jesus meek and mild. And it's just one of those stories where we can read it and we can marvel at the beauty of Jesus, right? And we can know that actually in our modern day age, actually people don't howl at the sky anymore. So we're probably all right. And we've all grown to the point where kind of evil influences, they're not really in play in our society. So we can relax, we can let ourselves off the hook. Until really recently, I was leaving work. And I came out, and I'm locking the gates, and there's a guy at the end of the road, literally stood, rocking backwards and forwards with his arms hanging at his side, periodically every 30, 40 seconds, just yelling at the sky. His clothes were tattered, his hair was unkempt. He was totally oblivious to the community around him, and those people walking the street acted as if they were totally oblivious to him. And I thought to myself, I didn't think people howled at the sky anymore. And then on that same day, I arrived on my street, and I'm getting out of the car with my boy, and there's a guy coming out of the hospital who every 20 meters or so stopped to sit on a wall and bang his own leg in pain and shout abuse at nobody. And I went over to speak to him, and he's He's talking about kind of medical incompetences. He's got this kind of mashed up leg, and he's talking about living in a bedsit because of kind of the injustice of the housing system. And it feels like he's at odds with everybody, and he's just dropped out at the bottom of the system. I said to him, "How far are you going?" And he said, I live up on the edge of Walkden. How are you going to get there walking like that every 20 metres? And I said, "Oh, I'm ex-military, I'll get there one way or another." I said, "How does that happen in our society? Like, ex-military used to be like at the core of our society, now just dropped out of the bottom, howling at the sky in pain. How does that happen?" And kind of I was reflecting on this one journey home, and I felt like God said to me that actually, Christians in Britain, sometimes we have a real proximity problem. That we kind of either forget or convince ourselves that this kind of poverty, spiritual poverty, isn't really there. Or we dehumanize it to the point of saying it's their fault. And that kind of blind ignorance can come from a lack of proximity, but when we're closer, it leads us to listen to people. It leads us to understand people. It leads us to pray for people. And suddenly it's like we're in a whole different world. In this narrative, there is no hint of Jesus considering this man's behavior as anything other than a symptom of the problem. In fact, Jesus aligns himself, not with the community, but aligns himself with the marginalized and the broken. And he does it again and again and again. And do you know what? I love him for it. I honor the kingship of God. I marvel at the splendor of his beauty and the creation that he's made. And I'm in awe of the spine-tingling purity and holiness, but it is his unswerving compassion and commitment to the broken and worthless that ruins me every time. Recently I was on a residential with a group of young people, and these were young people with complex needs. These were young people that had all been kicked out of mainstream schools, and we were taking them away on a trip over a half-term holiday to North Wales, where they would do some outward bound stuff, and we were telling them some of the gospel. And on the last night, we had a fire pit out, and we all sat around, and my friend, who has just the most incredible testimony about God rescuing him from all kinds of fear and sorrow and despair and broken relationships and God breaking in. So he stands up and he tells this story, which is an amazing story. And then at the end, we kind of just do some singing around the campfire, and I get talking to one of the girls, one of this teenage girl, and she began to tell me about her life. And she said that there'd been a huge family row, and everybody within the house had packed their suitcase. And it had come to this standoff point where Mom said to Dad, "If you don't go, we're going." And so he goes. But the reality is he stayed within the community just a couple of roads away from the house. But this girl said that she never, ever saw or heard from him. And she told me that she'd never been the easiest child, but that this rejection had kind of crushed her and left her feeling worthless. She started to self-harm, which spiraled out of control. And she showed me the scars on her legs and her tummy and her arms. She had, in fact, decided she was worthless because, in her words, her dad had been able to walk away from her in the same way as somebody would leave a bottle of shampoo in a hotel room. "That's okay. I'll get another one." She started to self-harm in school, and her behaviour spiralled out of control, and the school decided that they couldn't meet her needs, and so they referred her on to an alternative provision. Luckily for her, it was a Christian alternative provision. But the hidden message in all of this was, your dad's right. You aren't worth keeping. And she told me this whole narrative without flinching, because in her head, there was nothing to be surprised about, because she wasn't worth being upset over. And in that moment, a still small voice spoke to me and said, speak to her heart. Don't worry about her understanding or her intellect, how much of this she gets. Just speak to her heart. So I didn't know what to do. So I began to speak. I told her that her father sounded like an idiot, which wasn't the strongest of starts. And then I told her that she shouldn't measure her worth by him. I told her that she should measure her worth by her Father in heaven. I told her the Father who knit her together in her mother's womb, delighted in every hair, every bone, every vein in her body. I told her that those moments when she is in despair and on her own and cutting herself, that Jesus weeps with her, not in judgment, but raw sorrow and affection. And I told her that any moment that she considers herself without worth, that she should look to the cross. The cross where Jesus himself clung to nails, actively clung, not accidentally clung, but actively clung with everything he had, so that she might always know that God considered her too precious to leave behind. I told her that Jesus clung to nails so that she didn't need to be separated from her true father ever again. I told her that my dad left when I was a baby and that I spent my whole childhood trying to prove that I was worth something until Jesus showed up, saw right through all the nonsense, and told her that my dad valued me anyway. Not reluctantly, but with a passion that refused to let go. And I told her that my dad was her dad and that he is crazy about her. So crazy that he would heal her heart in the same way that he would heal the scars on her skin. And then I realised that those words had actually come out of my mouth. And I was like, oh no, why did I say that? So he's like, unfortunately, I can't do that. So we just need to pray and ask God to do that. So me and one of the female members of staff prayed with her. And then we said amen. We had that awkward moment where we were like, oh, what do we do now? And nice fire. That night she sat with one of the female members of staff in her bedroom who was putting her to bed. And she gave her life to Jesus. She prayed a prayer that said, God, I give my life to you. Jesus aligned himself with the broken. I love him for it. I love that he did that. I love that he does it again and again. Jesus taught us that how we treat the least of his brothers and sisters is a greater indicator of our love towards him than the correctness of our doctrine and the volume of our singing. He warns us that whatever you did not do for the least of these, you didn't do for me. Jesus aligns himself with the least. God has repeatedly spoken to his people about loving the unlovely. In Micah it says there is a unique call placed on God's people to act justly and to love mercy. In Zechariah we are instructed by the Lord Almighty himself to administer true justice. Show mercy and compassion to one another. Do not oppress the widow or the fatherless, the foreigners or the poor. And the gospel compels us to align our attitudes to God's attitudes. And it isn't just about being another social work project. It's about bringing the good news, the hope of Jesus, to those who are in crisis. Speaking to the heart, if you like. And it's never once with a sense of we're sorted and you're not. I'm together and you're in crisis. But no, because the gospel's completely different from that. What does it say? Once I was far from God because of my own behaviour. But now I'm reconciled to God, free from blemish and accusation through Christ Jesus. While I was still far away, in crisis, he loved me. And this is how I even know what love is, because Christ loved me first. When I was 19, I began to feel like I had no cause, like I wanted to be a rebel, but I had nothing to go for. I was striving without any sense of where I was going. And I had no idea what for. And I believe God spoke to my heart. My father helped me to see that I was broken. But he called me to find wholeness. That's the gospel. He loved me when I was broken. God's mercy came to me when I didn't deserve it. I couldn't earn it, make it, or achieve it. His mercy was free to me. And this is the reality of how mankind first encounters the living God and his good news. I can experience the good news of Jesus with all its benefits without earning it in any way at all. And that's how I share it. You don't need to earn it. You don't need to work for it. You don't need to strive for it. During the worship, I was thinking, what would be the one thing that God would say to you? I think during this time, God would want you to hear that still small voice that says, speak to the heart of the community around you. That as a church, you exist on a hill, city on a hill, looking out over communities. That as a collective and as individuals, he would have you speak to the heart of this community. One person at a time, through projects, through local government, through the institutions that you work in, through the businesses that you're in, the clubs that you're in, the streets that you live in, that he would have you speak to the heart of the community. And so this is what we're going to pray for as a close. So if you could stand with me, that'd be great. And if it helps you to close your eyes to focus on God, then do. Discourage you from standing looking at me, it will put you off no end. Father God, I just pray for your father heart in this church, God. That you remind each person here of their individual story. That point, as for me, it was as a 19-year-old feeling like I was just burning out and going nowhere. God, remind them of that point where they encountered you. Remind them again of the freedom of your love. Remind them again of the freedom of your mercy. Remind them again of just how freely and how willingly and how lovingly you take them into your arms. God, I pray in that encounter with you, there would be a sense of them speaking your heart to this community. Lord, I pray for the individuals that live near them, that they would speak your heart to that community. For those people that work near them, for those people they meet on the school gate, that they would speak your heart. Lord, I pray for those that are hidden away in crisis and brokenness. Lord, I pray that you would open doors that this community can reach them. Lord, let them be carriers of your Father heart. Well, let them be people that just unlock those closed doors in our community. Just feel God kind of, there's something in that image of locked doors. That there are homes in the community around us where there are locked doors, where there are secrets, where there are abused wives or abused children or addicts or people trapped in brokenness and they are locked up. And that God would commission you to be unlockers of those doors. He would commission you with his authority to not be people that bring torment or condemnation, but to be people that go to those that are lost in the tombstones, to be people that go to those that are lost in anger, fear, those that are howling at the sky. That he gives you a key to go and bring freedom. Father God, would you do that here, God? Just encourage you where you're stood to just start to pray for your community, for the people you know, maybe people you care about, maybe somebody in the community that you've seen on the shopping precinct time and again, and they just look broken. Just begin to pray quietly to yourself for those people. Lord, I pray for doors to be unlocked, lives to be unlocked. Lord, I pray for those that are outside of the community, among the dead, among the tombstones. Lord, I pray that this church would be a city of refuge for them, a place where they can find freedom, a place where they can find wholeness, a place where they can find forgiveness, a place where they can find you, Jesus, a place where they can find belonging. Lord, I pray that you would put your neon sign over the door, that all are welcome here. Lord, I just pray for a new season where it feels like you are doing something with these precious people, where they begin to think, we didn't plan for this, but who are these people that God is bringing to us? Lord, I pray for that. Pray for that season of people connecting with this church in a new way. Those that are on the fringe, those that are among the tombstones, those that are hurt, those that need hope. Lord, I pray that this church would be a community on a hill, a place of refuge that people can run to and find hope.